Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapists. Good morning, or good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Hank. It's nice to be here. Yes, we are gathering today, and as always, we're going to be exploring a subject that is near and dear to my heart, and I hope it is near and dear to your hearts as well. We're going to be talking about the teen years, adolescence, and I am very fortunate to have a guest in the studio with me today so that we can explore this topic in a wide range of areas, because being a teen, raising a teen, being a part of a teen's life is multifaceted. So I'm not going to be doing it alone. And we're also going to do it a little differently today than usual. We won't be opening up the phones for calls today. We're just going to have a conversation in the studio because I think the subject is so broad and there's so much to cover that we will fill this hour easily. But before we jump into the topic, I just wanted to kind of wrap up a little from last week's conversation when we talked about gatherings and circles and the idea that the world would be saved by Western women, as stated by the Dalai Lama in 2009. And he saw this as a potential because Western women have such great access to resources and education and the ability to hold the safety and care and nurturing of the future. And I bring it up again because the conversation started to center around the empowerment movement of women. And I wanted to remind us that part of the conversation was about creating these circles of support so that the conversation that women were having would change the global conversation, spread out into the collective conscience and change the way we see the world. And that's what we're talking about a bit today, is that this job of raising our young people to functioning, productive young adults and adults falls on the job that we do as their parents and their guides and their mentors and their teachers. And so having these circles of power, these circles of conversation, are ways that we can come together and kind of support each other on our path of raising children, of changing the world, of making social change happen. And so I just kind of wanted to keep that conversation going as we move forward, that I'm still interested in how you think we can start coming together with all of our various interests and skills and belief systems. How can we find each other and come together in a way that we can support change on greater levels? And this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can be part of this conversation by getting involved with our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or on my website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can always send me an email to Elizabeth Barrett, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And you can check out old shows, previous shows, by podcasting them at kcbx.org under the News and Talk tab. Just drop it down and all of our shows are there and you can catch up on what you might have missed. So we're going to talk about adolescence today. And I just launched my younger daughter, off to college, as you all know, this last fall. And she's not done with her teen years. She's just 18, although she's off in college and feeling like she's fully launched and fully formed and fully her own, you know, young adult in the universe. But anyone who's been through the process of raising teens and adolescents into young adulthood knows that it really doesn't stop. The development, the growth, the challenges really doesn't stop until the early to mid 20s. And so having, you know, still being in this process, I'm really fascinated about what it takes to raise a teen, all of the conflicting pressures that we get from society on what's the best way to raise our teenagers. And as always, my concern is that because we have such a abundance of research about teens, that we tend to pathologize a lot of what would be considered normal behaviors in teens, in those going through puberty, in our young adults. And we don't recognize that there is a wide spectrum of what is normal in their behavior, because it's overwhelming and a little frightening. And this period of time can be all over the place for the young person going through it, and also for the parents. And so I thought it might be helpful today to talk about kind of that large spectrum of normal and the different stages of adolescence that children go through, and to maybe help to demystify what it is to be a teen, and also to talk about when we should be concerned. What are some of those behaviors that teens display that parents should step in and talk or reach out for help or go and talk to an expert? And so to help me in the studio today, I brought in an expert, Dr. Joe Hollifield. How are you, Joe?
Oh, thank you, Elizabeth. Great.
We are colleagues from Cal Poly, and we've been talking over the last couple of years about this subject, and every time we see each other in the hall, we say, we should do a show about teens. And so I'm glad we finally got a chance to do this because you have quite an extensive background. Joe received his master's in clinical psychology and a doctorate in school psychology. Your early professional experience in psychology includes training in several children's psychiatric hospitals, residential treatment facilities, therapeutic day schools. Dr. Hollifield was involved in the early stages of developing Martha's Place Children's Assessment Center, which is located in San Luis Obispo. He's worked in several school districts as a school psychologist in the Midwest and here in San Luis Obispo County. And currently you're in private clinical practice in San Luis Obispo, and you work in the Atascadero Unified School District.
That's correct, yeah.
So you have some experience in the field of teens and adolescents.
Yeah, and I teach, too, at Cal Poly, so I'm pretty busy.
Yeah, and so what are you teaching at Cal Poly currently?
I'm teaching developmental issues in education, so it's kind of looking at developmental issues in within an educational context, so curriculum, social skills, so forth.
So these are for child development majors.
Yeah, or psychology majors that are interested in working with children. And then I'm teaching developmental assessment, so again, the tools we might use to work with kids or help gauge developmental process. And then I'm supervising students on their field placements and their some of their papers. But I've taught a taught course in adolescence last fall, so specific to this topic.
Yes. So. And you're a father?
Yes.
How old are your children?
10 and 12.
So you have an emerging adolescent.
Yes.
13. Oh, good. And I was teasing you a little bit before we started that there is something to be said for great research and experience, and there's a whole other thing to be said about the actual raising of a teen.
That is correct, yeah.
And I think that that's one of the things that no matter how much pre-training we think we've done before we are parents, the actual process of living through loving another human being and wanting the best for them and raising them is a completely different thing than knowing cognitively what should be happening.
Right, right.
And I think that's where I have my heart goes out to everyone who is involved in with a teen, as a parent, as a grandparent, aunt, uncle, cousin. It's a confusing time, and to know the best way to engage with teenagers can be a challenge.
Yeah, it definitely can be. And I think it's important to kind of, you know, understand that adolescence in general is a broad category. I mean, you know, starting from, you know, youngest at 10 all the way, like you said earlier, to the mid-20s. And, you know, a lot can happen in that developmental process, in the social process, in the peer group process, educationally. So I think it's important to, you know, you have to view not only the broad spectrum from a developmental age standpoint, but also from the you know, the different contexts that we view, or the lenses we view adolescent development as well.
So let's start a little bit back in history and time when we even started talking about this period of time of adolescence, because it's not something that has been studied forever. And I was looking at the work of G. Stanley Hall, who was, I guess, the founding father of...
Yeah, he's one more of the foundational aspect of kind of the theory and kind of the starting to really focus on adolescence as a group.
Yeah, and noticing that there was distinct behaviors that could be identified. So he describes this time as a period of storm and stress. And what I like about his description of the years of adolescence is that he calls it a time of contradictory tendencies, where you'll see a young person full of energy and excitement, then quickly followed by a sense of indifference and lethargy and loathing and never leaving their room. And then they'll burst into this period of exuberance and laughter and euphoria, and then follow that with this depressive gloom and melancholy. These contradictory tendencies of ego and vanity and conceit and self-centeredness that we can see in our teens as being very characteristic, as well as great shyness or self-loathing or a sense of being humiliated, that the remnants of their uninhibited childhood, their childhood selfishness, becomes connected to this increasing idealistic altruism, that you've never known a person so full of goodness and virtue as a teen who can then turn on you with incredible insensitivity and callousness, contradictory tendencies. So I imagine that, you know, I know that living with my teen through these years, I've experienced both of these feelings of storm and stress and also great joy and euphoria. But I also imagine that for the child or the teenager becoming a young adult, this feeling of storm and stress, confusion, changing has got to be overwhelming. So talk a little bit about what's going on in the life of a teen.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's going on in the life of a teen. Again,
from, I guess, different perspectives.
Yeah, it's multifaceted. And I think you have to we view childhood development from multiple perspectives. You have to view it in two, or actually three ways. One is the perspective or the lens. Okay, so there's the brain development lens or the neurological, biological lens. You know, what's going on,
what's developing and changing.
Inside. There's the behavior, what new behaviors are we starting to see, questioning more, being more assertive, striving for independence. There's the thinking level, the cognitive aspect that's starting to change. Adolescents are starting to now develop these thinking skills, their logical thinking, being able to think outside the box, plan more, having more, hopefully, at the end of adolescence, more impulse control. Mm-hmm. But that's still an emerging issue for them to kind of overcome. Emotional development, self-concept, self-esteem, trying to regulate their own emotions. Mm-hmm. You go back to the biological issue. There's hormonal changes that, are happening rapidly in early adolescence that, sometimes can cloud some of the cognitive and the emotional or just misinterpret. And then there's the social peer piece. Mm-hmm. Kids enter, sixth grade, especially when they go on to middle school, junior high, social groups, social status, as far as who they're with, becomes more weighted than what, for parents. But, not always, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes about, teens still value what parents have to say. So we still have a stake in this.
We say it, though, right, that makes the difference.
Well, how we say it, but, I think, what we know is that, from the social peer standpoint, when it comes to issues like love, relationships, what's going on, within their own social group, they rely on peers for mm-hmm. that input. However, parents still have that input with regard to practical day-to-day things, life-based issues like, getting a job, going to college, mom, dad, have you ever been in this situation, da-da-da-da, kind of those type of things that kids still rely on and teens especially rely on parents for that. They rely on parents, even though they may fight against it or say they don't like it, they like the structure.
And I think that's true through all periods of time raising our children, is that they will present as if they've got it all figured out, right? And you are just preventing them from having all the freedom in the world. Mm-hmm. But they do better when there are constraints that they have to conform to. So to have the feeling that they're always pushing against us is actually a benefit for teens. When we open the gates and allow them to do whatever is when they tend to go off the rails.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, there's a balance between control and being controlling and permissive as a parent. You know, there's certain parenting styles, and, you know, that relates more to the family system issue, you know, of, you know, that's the other perspective, you know, how, what's the interaction among family members within, you know, how they interact, allowing, you know, certain types of freedoms, you know, when, how, and then there's also the cultural perspective as well. You know, so there's you look at all these different perspectives, you can see how, you know, complex it can be. On top of that is that it's the importance of stressing what is typical for development for that period. So each, you know, you look at infancy, preschool, you know, early childhood, school age, and then adolescence. You know, each stage has some, you know, developmental task or skills that, you know, are achieved. And so what is it about adolescence that they're starting to try to figure out or achieve or haven't achieved yet? That's more important because, again, they look like adults.
Yes.
They're starting to act like adults. They're starting to converse with you as an adult. In most ways, you know, unless
they
they're,
argue with you or, as an adult,
unless it's sling, or something you're trying to pick up. And then, you know, it's that piece. So now you have to, when you start thinking about, you know, maladaptive behavior or atypical behavior, you really have to look at, is it developmentally appropriate? Mm-hmm. And what's the context? Is it, you know, is this a brain development issue, which we can't as parents, like, you know, scan the kid's brain and figure. But, you know, we can look at behavior. We can look at, you know, peer relations. We can start to think about it in that way. So it's you know, the interaction of development and those multiple contexts or lenses.
All right. So let's break it down for someone who is listening, a parent. You know, I'm thinking of myself driving along and I'm saying, okay, I love all the theory, but tell me specifically, you know, what are the tasks? What is my teen supposed to be accomplishing to successfully transition through adolescence into young adulthood? What are those tasks that they have to accomplish and I as a parent need to be helping them to achieve?
Right. I mean, an example would be like, you know, if you think about that last thing, it would be separation anxiety. So, you know, we know that late infancy and toddlerhood kids, that's typical. Mm-hmm. Preschool, that's typical.
To cry when mom drops you off.
Yeah, kindergarten. But, you know, if I'm outside of high school with one of my colleagues and a parent drops off a kid and all of a sudden they come back screaming, you know, for their mommy or daddy or running down, that might not be developmentally typical. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be rare. But then you have to think about the context, what might be going on in that student's life or that kid's life. You know, has there been, you know, issue, you know, a death in the family or some other type of issue that's stressing them out? That may not be a diagnosable situation. It just may be an atypical situation for that period of time. So when you think about different stages of separation anxiety or just anxiety around separation issues.
Moving away from family.
Moving away, transition, you know, college, you know, mm-hmm. you mentioned your daughter and so mm-hmm. forth and how, you know, that might be typical for that brief period or for a time being, and it may subside. I think when it becomes dysfunctional is when it starts to impact school, you know, work, if a teen has a part-time job, peer interactions, family interactions, and really it causes a lot of distress, you know. So I think it's important to view it from that standpoint. As far as skills, you have to think about, you know, the thinking skills. You know, this is the tricky part because we don't – often we you know, you may be sitting down doing your homework with your kids, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to when they get to calculus.
I never sat with my children doing homework. But I would watch TV while they were in the other room doing their homework so I could be in solidarity till midnight.
Or monitoring. Maybe that's a better word. monitoring their homework. But I think it's important to think about, you know, the cognitive task, you know, that, you know, what is typical? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, like I said earlier, it's more about the emergence of formal thinking as far as like what Piaget would talk about. That's a theorist, but it's, we want to think about being able to use logical sequences, you know, mm-hmm. putting things together, being able to have more impulse control, you know, in other words, thinking before you act, mm-hmm. which is adolescents are still inconsistent at that. I mean, pretty much the period between 10 and 14, especially 13 and 14 is a point where there's increased risk-taking behavior. And that's just natural with kids. I mean, they're going to think that they're going to – it's not going to apply to them. And so – but that subsides by the time they're in their late teens, early 20s.
Which is why so many parents say, I hope my child lives through their teen years, because we see that – desire for risky behavior. And you had mentioned when we were talking before that for a lot of children or teens, it's normal for them to believe that things won't happen to them,
right.
That we as parents can lecture them and tell them of all the dangers in the world, but they are incapable of actually believing that these things can happen to them.
And it's in the literature they call that, it's out of health psychology. It's called mm-hmm. the optimistic bias. And what that means is that it's, you know, it's related to the tendency to believe that accidents, illnesses, diseases happen to others, won't happen to me. You know, and so I think that makes it hard for parents when you're trying to talk about, you know, stress something important. You know, it's hard for prevention researchers or people trying to do prevention with teenage pregnancy or, you know, talking about, drug prevention. You know, they'll go through and they'll be able to report, you know, what they're supposed to do. But then the optimistic bias kicks in. Won't happen to me.
Can't happen to me. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and I'm joined in the studio today by my guest, Dr. Joe Hollifield. And we're talking about teens, adolescents, what is developmentally appropriate, when should we as parents or teachers or grandparents be concerned about teen behavior? What is that large spectrum of normal to abnormal? We're doing things a little differently today in the studio. We're not taking calls because there's so much to cover. It's such a broad field. But you can always get involved with the conversation by sending me an email to Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com or checking out our Facebook page or our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. And I start off by saying that this subject fascinates me because I've raised two teens. I'm almost done raising my second teen. This period of adolescence really expands from the ages of as early as 10, but really 12 or 13, to 21, 22. But now some of the brain research shows that emerging adulthood doesn't really happen until 25. So we're talking about a large period of time developmentally, and so much that happens. And so many changes happen so quickly that it can be overwhelming, not just for the teen, but also for the parent, but mostly for the young person going through it. And I think it's important to talk about what those developmental tasks are. How do we as parents know when our child has become a young adult or is going through emerging adulthood? And I know that there are some developmental goals for teens, and I'll name a few, Joe, and you can tell me mm-hmm. ready to go. And these are actually from 1951, these developmental goals. So it's interesting because some of them are a bit dated. But one of them would be developing different kinds of relationships with friends of both sexes, mm-hmm. deeper, more intimate friendships,
right.
Gaining emotional independence from parents and adults. So that doesn't mean never having contact with your parents, but developing a sense of identity separate mm-hmm. from your parents and other adults, achieving economic independence.
Right.
Is usually the final step towards actual launching into adulthood, selecting and preparing for an occupation,
mm-hmm.
developing intellectual skills and concepts necessary for civic competence. And I love this one because it's very much the 50s mindset, but I think it's also one of the skills that we don't emphasize for young people today because we're so busy with all the other things we want to teach them. But this idea of civic competence, you know, what it is to be, what are your responsibilities as a citizen and to this country and to giving back? Other goals and tasks of adolescent are achieving socially responsible behavior. So I guess that's what you're talking about, being able to control our impulses and.
Well, you know, it's interesting, you know, when I'm hearing you talk about this, is I think I start to think about, you know, another emerging skill for adolescents is perspective taking. And, mm-hmm. you know, kids have that ability early on, you know, in childhood before they reach adolescence. So basically perspective taking would be that the adolescent understands that another person has a different view from their own. But what changes now and what starts to emerge is that now the adolescent realizes that others understand that you have a different view from them, you know, and they might have a different view from you. And so it's more, it's compounded. And then as they learn that such perspectives are, you know, they start to learn over time that those perspectives now just aren't just social interaction based. You know, they're peer-to-peer. Is that, you know, how does that relate to their own role in society? In other words, you know, influence of the media, mm-hmm. Taking a stance on a social issue, you know, understanding those perspectives, you know, that, you know, if they read the book Divergent or The Hunger Games, that oh, it's different from what you know the movie is, and that you know now there's a different perspective, or that the director producer took a different perspective in interpretation and in showing it. So they start to get that, you know, or may become socially active in certain causes. So I mean, that's the difference from childhood emerging into adolescence and into early adulthood. So.
And how common it is also for the late teens to start having that existential, that first experience of existential angst, right? Of what does it all mean? What is the purpose of life? Kind of those deep
existence,
dark,
you know, yeah. You know, where do I fit into this, the bigger picture?
And so for parents, I can imagine that that is one of the conversations that becomes very anxiety provoking, because it's frightening when your teen comes to you and says, I don't get what this is all about. There's no purpose in life. What is the meaning? And how do we best sit with that? How do we best help our adolescents to kind of cope with those first pangs of existential angst?
And if their social, you know, interests or so forth differ from the parent's perspective. And I think that's, you know, that's what parents have to grapple with too at times. Okay, oh, they're going on a different viewpoint than my own, which can be healthy, you know, and I think it's, you know, it's depending on how to navigate that, nurture that, but at the same time, you know, keep yourself in check
yeah.
as a parent.
And I think that that's one of the things I mean, there's so many things I wanted to cover, but this idea that we know, if we understand that part of the normal development is having these existential questions, that our, you know, children are building conscious values in themselves. They're having their first kind of separation from what the parental influences and being influenced by their peers and by their own internal quest for wholeness. And so as parents, I think our primary job is to hold that space, to not get freaked out by what we see it going on in our teens, because I think as a parent, it's very difficult to raise this child, right, from infancy through childhood, where you as the parent are all and everything to your child. And then when they hit these years of kind of change and confusion and that normal developmental move towards emotional independence, as a parent, it would be normal to feel scared if your child is showing signs of depression or anxiety or existential angst or talking about what is the meaning of life. There is a tendency of parents to over-respond, right, to get overly concerned and to build this into a greater thing. And then the teen starts to think, oh, no, is there something wrong with me? Am I having bad, you know, are these thoughts wrong or abnormal? Am I strange? And so I think part of the work for parents is to be calm enough and understand that this is part of development and to breathe and listen and not overreact so that the teens can have these feelings and have these experiences and have these thoughts, but realize that they're still safe and okay and they're going to move through it. I think that's one piece of it. I think for parents, we are given so many, so much information that builds fear that, you know, one wrong move and our child's going to commit suicide, or if we say the wrong thing, they're going to become, you know, alcoholics, or if we don't respond in the right way, they're going to end up in the wrong peer group. I think parents get into such a place of fear that it makes it difficult to parent consciously. You know, we're just reacting instead of stepping back and saying, no, this is part of that contradictory tendencies that Hall talks about. So from your clinical perspective, you know, how can parents separate out what is normal, although scary, part of teen development? And when should a parent say, we're going to, you know, need to address it? And we're going to take a moment to think about this, and we're going to continue on with this conversation with a reluctant therapist in just a moment. I'm Elizabeth Baird, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, joined in the studio today by Dr. Joe Hollifield. He is a clinical psychologist, a colleague of mine at Cal Poly, teaching in the Child Development and Psychology Department. And we're talking about adolescence, those teen years, from kind of a professional perspective, a developmental perspective, and trying to offer you some ideas of what is normal, if there's anything normal about this time, and when should we maybe get a little concerned about the behaviors of our teens and adolescents? And so before we went into break, I asked you, Joe, so what are some behaviors that are normal, and when should we as parents be concerned?
And so I want to go back to, you know, the understanding of just adolescence in general, and that the big shift in middle school, you know, into high school, is more so with middle school, is that the amount of time with friends increases dramatically. And adolescents in general spend more time with their peers than they do with their family or by themselves. So it really becomes that peer social network. And so they also start to develop deeper friendships than they did with, kids in grade school, in fourth or fifth grade. So the nature of friendships change. And so since friendships are this central social relationship between adolescents at that time, the friendships are important to adolescents for several reasons. They're companions. They are emotional resources. And so, peers will start to rely on other peers for advice or emotional support. Now, it may not be good advice, or just listening. You know, I think adolescents are becoming more adept as we get into more of a psychology-based culture in the United States. I mean, they have access to a lot of things, and they can Google anything and find out, information. But more so, I think kids are becoming better at, understanding the psychological nature of social interaction. So, and they're also there for, conflict resolution. You know, peers are helpful in that way. I think when, as parents, it's when we start to, you know, certain signs starting, you know, they're, because parents may out there may, you know, ask their child or their adolescent, you know, how was your day?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What'd you do today? Stuff.
Right.
You know, and so you're not, you know, you're like, okay, well, I'm trying to be, you know, an engaging parent, trying to, you know, be involved. They may have already had that conversation multiple times with their peers, or, you know, they may not feel that you would understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's not that you shouldn't revisit, as you should, but, you know, maybe wait or revisit at an opportune time. You know, ask questions. I mean, I think signs you're starting to notice if they're starting to, you know, grades, you know, if you keep actively engaged with the school and noticing drops in grades or, you know, certain issues start to occur. I mean, when they're not as disclosing as sometimes they, you know, say they maybe they do. Maybe you have a very good relationship in a way that, you know, your adolescent will talk with you more, maybe sometimes than you want to. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, they talk.
More than you want to.
Yeah. But then they're not sharing as much, or they're becoming closed off at home, you know, and, you know, restrictive. So I think it's kind of trying to gauge any changes that you would notice happen.
In the sleeping and eating behaviors, you know.
Right.
We notice those. Anything that is quickly out of the norm for your child would be a red flag. But it doesn't also necessarily mean that something pathological
right.
or a disorder is developing, because the world of storm and stress, to go back to that period of contradictory tendencies, that in at some level it's normal for teens to feel exuberant and childlike and full of glee and laughter, and then to go into a dark melancholy and depressive and sit in their room. It's interesting because teens really thrive on periods of aloneness
mm-hmm.
during the teen years. At the same time, they're overcome with the desire for friendships and crushes, you know, so it is, everything is contradictory. So I think it's a dance for parents to understand that things can change rapidly to the positive or to the negative, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's pathological or a diagnosable disorder.
Correct.
But to be able to stay connected with your teen in such a way that they can process all of this with your support.
Right. And I think the biggest thing is really, you know, looking for a pattern
okay.
of differences. I mean, there's going to be, like you said, there's going to be fluctuations and changes and friendships change. I mean, you know, a long-term, you know, romantic relationship to an adolescent, maybe 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
you know, or exactly. 3 weeks. And so, you know, that changes as you go on to college and in adulthood, you know, about the interpretation of long term. And so I think it's important for parents just to, you know, monitor certain behaviors. You know, it's okay to go in the room, mm-hmm. even though they don't want you to go in the room. It's okay to go in and see what's going on, you know.
Our favorite parenting technique during the teen years was to just go into our daughter's rooms and lay on their bed. We just lay on their bed, lay with them on their bed, and they'd be reading or say, you think we're annoying or go away or why are you in here? And if I would just go in and lay on the bed and read a magazine, if I laid there long enough, she would start to talk to me or, you know, something else would come up. And I think there's a tendency for parents to pull back because teens are pushing us back, right? They're wanting their space, they're wanting their emotional distance. But as you mentioned before, they also still need us to be engaged in our life. And so to not take all of our cues from what our teen is telling us that they want, because they're sending out the same contradictory messages to us as they're feeling
mm-hmm.
inside. So if we look again at the developmental goals, we're supposed to be helping our children to launch emotionally, to find that sense of identity of who they are separate from adults and their peers. They're developing socially. So how do you create healthy friendships with others? What constitutes a healthy friendship? You brought up briefly long-term relationships, and I wish we had an entire hour to talk about. One of my concerns is this idea that having a boyfriend or girlfriend is something that's healthy or positive for adolescents or teens. And I think that we as a culture, many parents support this idea of boyfriend and girlfriends way too young. And the teens end up setting up these kind of mini marriages in these relationships, right? That they're very serious about being cheated on or spending time together or texting 24 hours a day. And they're too intense. And the children, they're children still. And emotionally, they don't have the ability to hold that kind of intensity. They have desire. The sexual desires are coming up, but the ability to emotionally handle that. Again, I think we need to revisit this idea of having long-term boyfriend and girlfriend relationships in high school, because that is when we have a high risk for suicidality or, you know, emotional problems when these relationships break up. So having said that, we're trying to help our children develop launch emotionally, launch socially, to develop healthy relationships, to launch physically. Mm-hmm. So to learn how to care for themselves, when to take showers, when to eat, when to sleep, when to exercise. These are skills that we as parents are supposed to be kind of modeling. Our schools are supposed to be modeling and teaching these skills so that they, our teens, are able to move into college and young adulthood, able to care for themselves. And then finally, financially, learning how to get a job, right, what they're interested in as their vocation. So given that those are kind of our four main goals for launching our teens and adolescents, if you believe your child is struggling, where do you feel parents should go? What's the best avenue for support?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, and all those other, when you think about how teens view themselves and so forth, in the whole issue of, you know, romantic relationships, teens are also, as kids, heavily influenced by, you know, our media culture.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, you know, it's important for parents to monitor the media culture as well. Mm-hmm. You know, what websites are they going to? What TV shows are they watching? And, you know, watch it with them.
Yeah. As much as you may not enjoy the show.
But you start to understand the culture. Mm-hmm. And then what are the cultural messages that are coming to your kids? You know, and I think it also strikes up opportunities for conversation, you know, especially if you don't think they understand, you know, or what do you think that meant, you know, or what do you think they're trying to say? Get them to use those emerging critical thinking skills. I think, you know, going back to your question, I think it's important to, you know, internet, we have a lot of wealth of information. We also have a lot of stuff that's not very good as far as, like, you know, misinformation.
That's what scares me. I rarely say go Google what you want,
right,
when it comes to mental health, because I think that it's mostly scare.
Right.
Scary
and
information.
So, I mean, I think
helpful.
It's really trying to look at, you know, various organizations, you know, that you know, are involved in the mental health field, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, the American Psychological Association, the National Association of School Psychologists, have websites, and they have parent links to information, you know, the American Psychiatric Association, so forth. I mean, you could go to National Institutes of Health. You know, you can go to the CDC websites. You know, those websites will have good information about, you know, disorders and, you know. And the important thing for parents to understand is, like, you know, not to just go through and look at a checklist of symptoms and, like,
say, this is my child.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, I can remember in graduate school when we were starting to talk about our, you know, diagnoses and our courses, our professor said, you know, be careful, you know, of going through your diagnostic manual, because you're going to find stuff, and, you know, you can run into this medical student syndrome where you have everything.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I think it's important not to, you know, go through and just check everything off and say, well, that's my kid. Mm-hmm. You know, as I mentioned earlier, it's multifaceted. And,
right.
You know,
there's a lot of influences in your child's life, not just what's going on in their head.
Right. And so, you know, the other thing is reaching out to the school. You know, and checking in with school counselors, teachers. I mean, if you think about it, at least for early elementary, you know, the parent-teacher conference is a good opportunity for those two systems to come to interact and talk about a child's development. Well, that changes in middle school.
Yeah, parents kind of stop showing up for those things.
Well, I mean, the nature of the curriculum also changes. You have six classes versus one,
right, not
you know,
just
six
one
teachers. And so really it's about reaching out to the school counselor. And, you know, they, you know, some districts now are starting to get family advocates where you can, you know, if you go to certain districts' websites, they will have, you know, a link to their family advocate or someone to contact that can talk to parents about community resources. And, you know, there's agencies here, you know, that you can get information from as well.
So if a parent is concerned about their child's behavior, they think they might be depressed or, you know, they're failing in school or they had a breakup and they call you as a clinical psychologist and they come in, what kind of work are you doing? Do you see just the teen? Do you see the whole family system? Do you disclose to the parents what's going on? You know, it might be helpful for parents to understand, what is it I'm getting into if I call a clinical psychologist?
Yeah, clinical psychologist, marriage and family therapist, you know, I think it's whomever the professional is, I think it's important to, you know, everybody's going to have a different approach, mm-hmm. you know, based on their training and experience and then their, their approach to understanding, you know, issues. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think it's, you know, usually for a young teen or usually it's going to, you know, be the parent that's going to make the call.
Right.
Or a school might, you know, make a call for the parent or say, I've referred this family to you. They may be calling. And typically it's going to be with the parent, you know, just trying. And I usually try, again, view things in the lens of normalcy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
assuming that all is well
exactly.
until proven otherwise.
You know, right. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes it's there's, you know, I realize parents are concerned, they're anxious and trying mm-hmm. to listen to them and get a sense of their concern. And then trying to, in my mind, I'm trying to, okay, is this typical mm-hmm. of development? Is there some things I can do over the phone to reassure them? I mean, it's a business, you know, and it's like you don't want to turn away business, but at the same time, you want to educate. And I think it's important to educate parents and not over-pathologize a situation. So then what I do is, you know, I may have them come in, meet with them, and then may have meet with the adolescent alone outside of the parents.
Mm-hmm. And then how much are you required to report to the parents once you're working with the teen or the adolescent?
That depends on the teen. You know, some teens, they don't want to, you know, want to disclose. And that's, you know, I have to explain to parents, you know, this is what we are working on. And of course, sometimes parents want to know what's going on. It's like, well, let me work with your teen. And usually what I try to do is support the teen to get them to a point to where they can have a session with their family and help them, advocate for them and mediate that process for them. So give them the skills to talk to them about some of the issues. If it's related to the family, it may not. You know, maybe just other stuff going on.
And that's why I think it's important for parents to be very conscious of who they hire to work with their teen, because there is going to be that relationship that develops, hopefully with the clinician being in support of the teen, but you also don't want it to become an alliance between the clinician and teen that alienates the parents,
right?
Because I think sometimes we run the risk of that. So knowing who you're hiring is so important, and knowing that the person you hire to work with your family has an expertise and understanding of this period of time, because it's very specific. And just because we've gone and earned our master's degrees or our doctorate degrees doesn't mean we have training or experience in that field or that area. And I think that's also important. And it kind of brings me up to the work in the schools. You know, what's happening in our school districts? What kind of support do we have for our students' mental health? And you know, as always, I have concerns about, you know, our profession and how we are best treating or seeing or supporting the mental health and well-being of our students. And it concerns me that our school districts, you know, have let go of psychologists, school psychologists, or the psychologists they have on staff don't get to do face-to-face work with students that much because they're so busy with paperwork. And I don't know if parents realize that we assume when we send our children to school that we have this support system in place of guidance counselors and school psychologists that are looking out for the mental health and well-being of our students. But unfortunately, we're really lacking in that area, that our mental health support and services are not stellar. Mm-hmm. And that for many of the school districts, they're actually subcontracting out the mental health services to different agencies. And we have no guarantees that the providers from these agencies have any experience working with teens. So having said all that, not to alarm parents, but to make you understand that we cannot assume that just because it is a school district and they have mental health services, that these services are really covering all of the needs of our students.
And to that extent, I think it's, you know, it's an emerging model.
Okay.
That's coming up. You know,
we're just actually learning how to best do this.
Well, I think it's. You know, what's happened is there's parallel models that are occurring. You know, there's the Mental Health Services Act. You know, that's based on the Kaplan model, which, you know, looks at prevention, secondary intervention, and kind of outside, you know, intervention as well. And then within the schools, it's called response to intervention. You know, the Kaplan model looks at a semicircle, for their visual, and then the schools look at response to intervention from a pyramid. So they try to have universal prevention for all kids at, you know, the bottom of the pyramid, you know, tier one, they call it. Kids that aren't successful theoretically go to tier two, which is, you know, additional support. So schools are starting to, you know, it's been around for about a decade, the response to intervention, and it's mostly been on instructional. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot on the emotional and behavioral from the research. Schools are trying to figure out a way to implement it. You know, there are best practices models, but, I mean, they're rare. And so I think it's trying to, like you said, I think it's really trying, districts are trying to figure out how to integrate that response to intervention with either the personnel they have, or if they don't have the personnel or the budget doesn't allow for it, we got to get some people in. And so it's an emerging area.
If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I had the pleasure of having a guest in the studio today, Dr. Joe Hollifield. He's a clinical psychologist. He's also a colleague of mine at Cal Poly, teaching in the Child Development and Psychology Department. And today we've been talking about teens and what is it like for a teenager going through this period of stress and storm and change, and what is it like for parents trying to help navigate this time period with our teens. And we've just moved into this conversation about how to best support families and students who might be struggling. And I brought up the concern about how and if our school districts are our schools are really able to address it. And I think, you know, I hear you talking about models, and mm-hmm. all I'm thinking in my head is a model is not
right.
human contact.
Right.
And so that's what so concerns me, is that we're so removed from human contact, face to face. Hey, how you doing today, Sally? What's going on mm-hmm. in your classes? You know, the teachers have the best contact with the
right.
students. They have the best relationships. So why aren't we doing more to nurture and empower our teachers to be a resource for mental health support? And why aren't we making time for that? Because we can teach all of the STEM we want, but if our children are struggling emotionally or with their mental health, they're never going to achieve anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can get into the best university in the United States or in the world, but if you don't have the resilience or emotional or mental health strength, you're not going to make it through college.
Right.
And we're not supporting students. I mean, I know you have much more. I don't want to take you down that path, but I just keep feeling like there's a lot of parents who are listening thinking, well, if my student's struggling, where do I go? Who
right.
do I trust?
Well, I think you have to look at, you know, back east, you know, in the larger metropolitan cities. I mean, you know, in certain neighborhoods, and it could go bode well here too. And the school is the hub of the community.
Absolutely.
And so and it permeates out. You know, to other areas, because we have the kids, what, 6-7 hours a day. And so things are going to come up. And I think it's really trying to understand that good social emotional development can have a positive impact on academic development.
Absolutely.
And so you have to have both. And so I think, you know, it's really has been about academic development, and we've done a really good job with increasing that and changing that.
Clearly, we have high test scores across the board.
but I mean,
does that translate to healthy, thriving human beings?
You know, it's holistic. You know, it's multiple perspective. You know, the cognitive academics, one aspect. You know, there is the emotional, the social. And I think it's, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what each school system needs are, because the community needs might be different. You know, you think about what's the continuum of support or continuum of services for kids instructionally, and what's the continuum support of social emotionally. And I think districts are, you know, trying to identify those areas. There's the difference, you know, between identifying and then planning and then implementing.
And that's where I feel like we fall so short, because like in many aspects of the mental health field today, we're great at diagnosing. We have tons of disorders. We have a huge DSM. You know, we are magnificent at pathologizing the human experience. But when it comes to actually sitting with a human being, with an individual, with a teen, and talking to them and hearing their story and supporting them and helping to normalize the internal struggles they're feeling, when does that happen? Because I feel like we talk a lot in theories and the district talks about models of service, but where is the hands-on? I really feel like it goes back again to the teachers, who are the only ones that have any consistent hands-on experience. And as a parent, I think your best resource is that relationship you develop with the teachers who are spending 6 to 7 hours a day with your student, and to build a rapport and alliance with them.
Yeah, and the teacher, you know, more so in elementary school. But, I mean, you know, I think it's also going to be, you know, when you get into, again, in secondary, middle school, and high school.
High school teachers are brilliant.
Yeah.
It's going to be having
the contact with the teacher. But, you know, I think it's also looking at the resources, the school counselor. And I think it's really just about becoming familiar with the resources that each school offers. You know, and, you know, schools will often have back to school nights. They'll talk about these things, or, you know, catalogs, you know, that are sent out. I mean, sometimes parents read them, sometimes they don't. We're all busy.
Catalogs?
Yeah, exactly.
You mean flyers about what's going on at school?
But I mean, I think it's important to realize, I think there's an awareness. And so I think there's what you're talking to, I think the difference between, okay, great, there's an awareness. What's the response?
Yes. And I think that that's where we still have a lot of work to do. Hence the conversation with a reluctant therapist, because I continue to have this frustration that as a talk therapist, I value that face-to-face and the healing properties, or the ability to help another person deal with and struggle with those internal issues in a face-to-face context. And yet we're so caught up in theory and models that we miss that. Our teens are, you know, are distanced from us because of our fear to engage with them on a human level.
Right.
And so I guess to kind of wrap things up today, what would be your wish for an adolescent?
A wish for an adolescent?
Yes.
That's a large one,
but you have to do it in like 30 seconds.
That, you know, that our adolescents, you know, have a very good sense of self, their identity, that, you know, good social connections, a good aspect or future view, and a good emotional support.
And this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I want to thank my guest, Joe Holifield, for being here today. And thank you always for tuning in and supporting your public radio station, KCBX.